Good morning and welcome to today's virtual media conference to apprise you of government's efforts to combat COVID-19. Today with me are the Minister of Health, the Honourable Terence Dyal Singh, the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Roshan Parasram, and Dr. Joanne Paul, Head of the Pediatric Emergency Department at the Eric Williams Medical Sciences Complex. The Minister of Health, the Honourable Terence Dyal Singh, will provide an update on COVID-19 in Trinidad and Tobago.
Thank you very much, Minister Cox. Good morning to ladies and gentlemen of the media, all citizens of Trinidad and Tobago, wherever you are listening, viewing, the Chief Medical Officer to my left, Dr. Roshan Parasram, and our expert this morning to educate the public about COVID and the pediatric population, Dr. Joanne Paul. What is the global situation today? Right now, there are 2,503,392 cases of COVID in over 200 countries and territories. 2.5 million. Is anybody's guess when we are going to meet 3 million? It seems to me just about a week ago, a week and a half, we were talking about 1.5 million. And when we reach 2 million, we are now at 2.5. That's as we stand now. Globally, 171,796. And persons recovered to date, 659,462. It is against this backdrop of this global pandemic that I now report to the country what we are doing in addition to the capacity that we have to treat with COVID-19. As we build redundancy, as we build extra capacity to cope with the second and third waves, which are inevitable, as we have seen in countries abroad. The AREMA facility will be operational by Friday. That will host 94 cases. We are using that facility in parallel with CORA for mainly suspect cases, pediatric cases, which Dr. Paul will speak to, and also, in case we have people on dialysis who are COVID positive and need to be dialyzed, they will be dialyzed separately at AREMA. So that is basically what AREMA will be used for. You have the capacity and the type of cases it will be used for. Augustus Long, 50 beds, that will be used in a similar vein to Couva, for acute and critical cases. As far as Tobago and the promise of 4 ventilators are concerned, I had a discussion on Sunday with the Secretary of Health, Tracy Davison-Celestin. The ventilators promised are still stuck in Panama, but what we are doing, we are taking 4 ventilators from Trinidad and sending them to Tobago by hopefully tomorrow. So between tomorrow and Friday, they should reach Tobago. Because we have to also have Tobago ready in case they get an unfortunate spike. So far, they have 5 and they have never used the 5. But we want to give TRHA extra capacity in the unlikely event that they do get a spike. So they will have 9 ventilators by the end of the week. So that is as far as building out extra capacity is concerned. I would now like to bring the country and you, ladies and gentlemen of the media, up to date on what is happening at some of our decanting facilities. At Brooklyn, we currently have 21 persons. The home of football, we were able to transfer 23 persons out of Couva to that step-down facility. So as far as step-down facilities are concerned, you have 21 in Brooklyn, 23 in Home of Football. And I want to thank the communities for accepting this. And I also want to thank the healthcare workers who have to live with these patients. Remember, when you put people into a step-down facilities, nurses and other healthcare workers actually have to live with these people under the same conditions. So, and in Tacarigua from today, the Barbados contingent, 33, will be housed at Tacarigua. So across three step-down facilities, we are going to have 77 persons. And when you marry that with Cora and Coover, where you have 36 people, across the parallel system which we have built, we have 120 persons across the parallel system. I say this to let you know that this parallel system that we have built out has never been done before. And while it is not a boast, it is to just thank healthcare workers and thank these patients who go into this parallel healthcare system. We have never done this before. And the reason I'm saying that is that there are going to be one or two hiccups along the way. But don't let those one or two hiccups define what is an excellent plan at the parallel healthcare system. And I want to make the point, while we do this for the first time, our regular healthcare system is also working, albeit with some adjustments, as you know about. So these 120 persons spread across our facilities, we have to regard them as pioneers. We want to thank them for the feedback they are giving us so we can make things even better. It's a learning experience for all of us. And as we move forward with this parallel healthcare system, we will learn, we will improve, but at the end of the day, I think Trinidad and Tobago should be extremely proud of where we are. This has never been done before. And I want to thank both the patients who are working with us, the healthcare workers who live with these patients in these step-down facilities, and ask that the feedback that we get will only help us improve as we move forward. So that's my brief update as to where we are as we build out more facilities, as we send 4 ventilators to Tobago, and where we are with decanting and accommodation today with the 2 groups of people who are coming in from Barbados. Thank you very much, Minister Cox.
Thank you, Minister. The Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Roshan Paraswaram, will provide us with a clinical update.
Good morning, Honourable Ministers, members of the viewing and listening public. So in terms of the clinical update for today, 21st of the 4th, 2020, we have submitted 1,380 tests to CAFA thus far. There are unique individual tests in the amount of 1,157, meaning we have repeated on a person more than once 223 tests a day. In terms of total number positive, we have 114 persons. Total number of discharges, 26. We would have had 4 persons going home from the facility at Sandy Grande last evening. Total number of deaths, there would have been 8. Total number of new patients, none over the 24-hour period. So hospitalized between Coover and Cora, we now have 36 persons after we had the decanting, as Minister would have said last night, to the new facility at Home of Football of 23 persons. We have 10 persons remaining at Cora, all are stable. And at Coover, there's no persons in the ICU. There's no one in the HDU, high dependency unit. There are patients split between the first floor and the third floor. In the first floor, we have new patients that would have come in over about a week or so. On the third floor, we have patients that are actually resolving in terms of their symptoms, so they have much milder symptoms on that particular floor. So in total, 26 people within the Coover facility. So as Minister would have said, 21 persons at the Sandy Grande facility and 23 persons at the Home of Football. Minister Cox?
Thank you very much. Let's hear from Dr. Joanne Paul, head of the Pediatric Emergency Department at the Eric Williams Medical Sciences Complex, who will focus on COVID-19 and children.
A good day, Honorable Ministers, Chief Medical Officer, members of the media, and members of the public. I'm just here to talk about a few tidbits on COVID-19 in children. I know we have already heard a lot about how it's less severe. The fact that it is milder in children. In terms of the reason why they're not sure, there are 3 theories about this. The first theory is that the receptors on the lungs in children, they have less of those receptors. So the virus has less receptors to attach to. So it's almost like children have an extra force field. And so they have less virus coming to their system. Or the other theory is that their immune system might not be as developed as adults. So therefore, there's less immune reaction to the virus. And so when you have all those inflammatory changes with the lungs, you have less so with children. And so they're a little bit more stable with regards to that. The third theory is that children have lots of viruses. So they're exposed to lots of viruses in that first 5 years. And so they might have some cross immunity. They're not sure which theory is most accurate, but we think is a theory with regards to the receptors. And so for the while, the end result is that children are much less severe than adults are. Now, although I'm saying that, we also have those vulnerable populations. We have the ones who are sickle cell disease, the ones who are less than 2 years old. We have also the cerebral palsy, the uncontrolled asthmatics, the ones who have heart conditions, the ones who have cancer. So don't let's just have a carte blanche approach and think that all kids are totally not vulnerable at all. We have those populations who are much more vulnerable, but generally, for some reason, they're not sure about children still are much less severe than adults. How will children present? I'm often asked. They usually present with the same thing as adults do. We have cough, fever, sore throat. If they get worse, they'll have shortness of breath and go further to have chest symptoms. What do we do? So I'm just going to respond by having the common questions and then I'll answer them for you. So parents often ask me, what do I do if my children have mild symptoms? So if we have the mild cough, the mild runny nose, what do you do at home? The thing is, you would never be sure. So if there's been no contact with a COVID-positive patient, or a person who has had any recent travel and your child just has very mild symptoms, a mild cough, maybe a low-grade pyrexia or fever, and also some runny nose, you keep them at home, at home. You make sure, though, when they're coughing to their elbow. Make sure they have hand hygiene and make sure they're not exposed to an older person in the home, like someone who is over 65 years old or someone who has lots of medical conditions. So if they're mild, have had no contact, you take care of them at home. If, for instance, they are mild and they have had contact with a COVID-positive patient or someone who has had recent travel who you're not sure about their COVID status, what you will do is contact your pediatrician, your medical, your general practice person or your family doctor, or go to the community in terms of the normal health centers that the minister had spoken about where you can be tested, and then at that point in time they can be tested. If, for instance, you're worried about them because they have more moderate symptoms, so moderate symptoms include we say respiratory distress. So we're looking at things like nasal flaring. So the nose starts to flare, they start to breathe faster, they have it where right here they're sinking in a little bit more, and they're breathing with all their chest muscles are breathing faster and harder. They also, on their abdomen, they're having abdominal breathing. In addition, if you look at their ribs, you're seeing the ribs coming up and down in a V. So if you're seeing all those things and they're breathing faster and harder, you think they might be having more distress. There's now moved on to shortness of breath and there might probably be a chest infection there. If that happens, so when we've moved on past mild to moderate, do not stay at home and think, if I go outside, I'll get COVID. If I go in the hospital, I'll get COVID. You must be aware this is your child. It's your responsibility to take care of them. So at that point in time, the same thing as before, your pediatrician, your family doctor, your local health center, your local peripheral emergency departments, and also just general hospital. Come to us so we can take care of a child if the child is moderately ill. All right, do not stay at home. People also ask me, what do we do in terms of masks? When do I have my child wear a mask? If the child is less than 2 years old, no mask. If the child is more than 5 years old, definitely they should have a mask on. Between 2 years and 5 years old, they may, if they can tolerate a mask, that's fine. If they can't, if they're taking the mask and sucking it, chewing it up, running their nose all over it. It makes no sense. So try to focus on hand hygiene and all the other things we had spoken about before the mask. Do not think the mask is that extra force field that will prevent everything. If they can wear it, fine. If they can't, focus on the other aspects. So just going through again in terms of where we're going to. If they're mild and they have had no contact, they stay at home. If they're mild and they've had contact with COVID, you have to get them tested. If they're moderate, they're in hospital. If, for instance, someone, your child is confirmed positive, when they go to the health facility, they will be there with you. It would not be about the child by themselves. We always have, it's always a family. They will be with their one parent or one guardian. Now, I know we've spoken about the physical aspects. I want to make sure we understand about the mental aspects, which is actually as important. Because we have your child and you at home continuously, kids are really scared about what's happening with COVID. We ourselves are stressed, and we forget how stressed they are. They're a little bit worse off. They don't know how what's happening. They're not sure what's happening. So if they're younger, they might be confused. But although if they're adolescent, they might not completely understand, similar to what those young boys were doing. So what do you want to really sit down and explain to them? Think about their stress factor. So in a whole day, and when you think about having a routine, have some exercise, some play, less screen time. Don't just put the tablet in front of them for the entire day. Have some family time, academic time. At nighttime, you could read to them and read stories to them. For instance, there's this storybook called My Hero Is You. And you can go online. It's published by WHO that tells you about COVID and how to handle it. So you can read that story to your child. The other thing is vaccinations. Please, 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 if you do have to give your child, if you have to be immunized, do not stay at home and say, well, I can't go outside. Please still go out there and have your child immunized. We don't want, at the end of this year, we have a whole slew of patients and children who have missed their immunizations, who are now extra vulnerable. So I want to just reiterate a few things in micro summary. Most of the cases are mild. We have the vulnerable populations. I want us to also make sure, talk to our younger age group and our adolescents. They're on both extremes. They may not completely understand what's happening. You have to let them be there with you and understand this process. The other thing is, don't forget to immunize your child. Don't be afraid to do that. And the last thing is that, think about the mental health aspect. That's equally as important. At nighttime, give your child some TLC, your stress, their stress. We have a long marathon session, a good few months, and we're all in this together. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Paul. Members of the media, the floor is now open. Remember to identify yourself and the media house you represent before posing your question. And remember, we want to give as many of you an opportunity to pose questions to us. But that means in our limited time, we will have to give each media house a chance to get a maximum of 2 questions in. Once we have completed the pool and time allows, I will come back to you. So let us keep this in mind as we begin to take your questions. CNC3.
Hi, good morning to the panel. Jesse Rounder from CNC3 News here.
Good morning, Jesse.
Minister, pardon me if this was addressed previously.
No problem.
The holy month of Ramadan is nearly upon us. It's just a couple of days away, right? What's the message to the Muslim community in light of the fact that fasting is often broken at mosques? Are you concerned that some may disregard government's Jadwam order and their call to practice social distancing? What's your message to the Muslim community?
Sure. Thank you. Before we had our first case of COVID, Senator Kazim Hussein put together a meeting with the entire Muslim community and myself at Charleville. At that meeting, every single leader of the Muslim community pledged their support. I have seen in the newspaper where various heads of the Muslim community are advising their followers how to maintain their religious obligations at home. So I think I have no fear that the Muslim community, in combination with all other religious communities, the Catholics, the Anglicans, the Presbyterians, who have been very, very responsible, because we all understand that we need to have social distancing, and the only way we can save lives is to stay home. So I am confident that the meeting which I had with the Muslim community way before we had our first case will yield the appropriate result. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. We move to 98.1.
Good morning, ministers, and good morning to the panel. Stephen Cummings here from 98.1 FM.
Good morning.
On the issue of bed per population ratio, Minister Dayal Singh, you said that Trinidad and Tobago is estimated to have about 3.3 beds per thousand, which translates roughly to less than a third when compared to one international benchmark. Do you see the need for an increase in our bed capacity at this time in light of COVID-19 cases that still remain a threat to us? That's the first question.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, I'm still pressing the question, Minister, I raised earlier on government's engagement of a team of foreign experts in helping us to understand this COVID-19 situation. Are those consultations still active, and have they been completed? And if so, what were some of the agreed to positions?
Sure. So, prior to COVID or post-COVID, we activated 230 beds at Couva, extra capacity, 50 at Augustus Long. We activated an extra 75, I believe, at Couva. We have activated an extra 94 at Arima. We will be activating across the board. That is how much? A couple hundred, and we can add it up. So the answer is yes, we have activated an entire parallel healthcare system to deal with COVID. Oh, I have it here. The total number of available beds to deal with COVID across convalescence, primary, secondary, and tertiary is 924 beds. So that's a vast number that we have activated in the parallel healthcare system. So I hope you are comforted by that answer. The CMO will address the second part.
Yeah, so if you could just repeat your second part quickly. You hearing him?
Repeat the second question,
please. He's talking, but you're not hearing.
Question had to do with the engagement of a team of experts to help government better understand the COVID-19. Are those consultations still active?
So in terms of a team of experts, we always have at our disposal international experts. We liaise through the Pan American Health Organization, who is the regional arm of WHO. The Caribbean Public Health Agency is a Caribbean-wide group of experts that actually consult with us as well. We would have had both clinical and other sessions with members from China, actually virtually, with the clinicians that were seeing cases on the ground, and that is ongoing continuously. I myself has had some interaction with persons from Louisiana and other parts of the U.S., in terms of the clinical response and even the epidemiological response to the so that is, there's collaboration internationally, but our direct lines are through PAHO and CAFA as it relates to the international experts.
Thank you, Doctor. ACP News.
ACP News. Minister, the Trinidad Nationals in Suriname say that they are to be tested, but the authorities there say they don't have any test kits, or rather they want us to send some test kits. I don't know if you could look into that for them.
I will. Thank you very much, Prior.
So the next question is, we have gone 7 days without a new case of COVID-19. Is this, you think, an indictment on the way that you're handling things so far in this crisis? And are we seeing the curve flatten? Have we flattened the curve at this point in time?
In what context are you using the word indictment?
How do you think you have managed it? You know, is it because of the measures you have used? Do you think that has something to do with the way in which you have that no new cases have cropped up so far in 7 days?
I'll answer the policy part, and then the CMO will answer the clinical part. It must be remembered that Trinidad and Tobago took firm action from as early as January 30th. We were the first country in the Western Hemisphere to introduce the issue of a travel restriction for one country. Then we added five other countries to bring it up to six, because we were tracing what was then an epidemic turning into a pandemic. So we were tracing the epidemic that started in China. We traced it going on to Asia, Hong Kong, Korea. Then we traced it going into Europe. And then we added more countries. And then finally, we took the firm decision to add, France and a couple other countries. And then two firm decisions. One, to suspend the rest of the cruise ship season. And two, to finally close our borders. It is a combination of taking those measures led by the Honorable Prime Minister and the Cabinet in conjunction with the public health officials, senior public officers, which I think may have led to us being prepared. We also took a decision in early January to build out the parallel healthcare system, because what we did not want was to have to treat COVID suspect or positive cases in a crowded hospital setting. That is a recipe for community spread. That is a recipe for disaster, because it means now your entire healthcare system is compromised, is infected, and things will just collapse. So I think those policy decisions that we took, both at the level of the Prime Minister and the Cabinet and at the Ministry of Health, may have led to a manageable situation. However, as we keep saying, if we do not adhere to the calls to stay home, the second and third waves may crash the system. And let me just end by saying, the barometer I use every morning, because I leave home at the same time every morning, is the traffic I see outside the Central Market and the Lighthouse. And let me see, the traffic I am seeing now is the regular August vacation traffic you will see when school is out. So if you minus the school traffic, what I am observing anecdotally at the Lighthouse and at the Central Market from yesterday, Monday, is increased traffic on the road. So if we do not adhere to the orders, to the requests, to the moral suasion to stay home, all these best laid plans will come crashing down upon us. And I now turn over to the CMO to handle the clinical part.
So just to take over from where the Minister left, if we do not adhere to the stay-at-home measures, what can happen? And if you look at it, we are at the sporadic phase, which means that we may have one or two cases of local spread in between. If those one or two persons would move around, and we can see the issue of a person maybe just having some mild symptoms, moving around like normal, going to a supermarket, going to a market, going to a large group of, where a large group of people congregate, or even within a household setting. For instance, if you have large apartment buildings and one person is infected in that kind of scenario, you can have from that one person spread to thousands of people, as we have seen in other parts of the world. So we are actively looking for what we call clusters in the community, which is basically groups of cases in a particular locality. So that is what we are actively looking for at this point, to see if we have one person or two persons in close proximity geographically linked, and we are using the GIS system to do so as well. We are tracing primary, secondary, tertiary contacts. So we are being pessimistic at this point, actually looking for clusters, because we don't want to think that we are in a situation that will stay static. We have to look for the outliers, and that's what we do on a daily basis to ensure that we're not getting cluster formation. And if we see two cases that are geographically linked, we need to put extra pressure in those areas to ensure that it remains two and it doesn't go up to 10 or 15 or 20 or 1,000. So that is the stage we are at in terms of the virus and the progression.
Thank you very much. Express.
Good morning, Camille Hunt Express.
Morning.
I'm following up on Pryor's question a little bit, where he noted there's been no new cases in 7 days. Minister Dayal Singh, is this progress towards reopening of activities? I'm just trying to get an idea of what criteria has to be met before places are allowed to reopen. Do we have to have like a declining number of cases for a certain period of time? And Dr. Parasram, the Barbados contingent, are they going to be tested when they arrive? Can you give a little more detail on what procedure is going to apply to them?
So I will thank you, Camille. I will take the first part of the question. The Honourable Prime Minister at his press conference, at the post-cabinet press conference last week, Thursday, said to the nation very clearly, if I remember, he would start to look at where things are by the end of this week. He will consult with the public health officials led by the Chief Medical Officer and the Honourable Prime Minister based on the science, because he emphasized at his press conference the role of science in this. Based on science and data, the Honourable Prime Minister will start to indicate, will start to consider by the end of this week what the plans are. But it is too soon, and I don't want this question to be misinterpreted by the public. It is too soon to talk about reopening. It is this talk about reopening that will throw us back to the Stone Ages. Please do not give the population the impression that we are even thinking about reopening. We have to stay the course until April 30th. Loose talk about reopening will throw us right back. Will throw us, slingshot us right back to the Stone Ages. We don't want that. Let us keep the course. Let us keep the pressure on. Let's keep the social distancing on. Let's stay home, and we will beat this together.
Yeah. In terms of the Trinidad nationals who would be coming back to Trinidad, I have been in constant contact with the CMO in Barbados to determine what were their medical status as well as their public health status while they were in Barbados. So a report is pending from Dr. Best. Will come across to me shortly. He just indicated to me a very short while ago that he's attempting to test them before they come. We may get those results, not before, but in a short while thereafter. So in terms of the testing, they will be tested as well. Our medical personnel, led by the County Medical Officer of Health, would actually do a full medical assessment of every person that comes to Trinidad. They would also do a public health assessment to determine their risk of contracting or spreading COVID. So that has to be done only when they get here and will be done by a team of experts in County St. George East and St. Andrew St. David. So once that is complete, we will have a better sense of, in terms of quarantine, where can they be quarantined, whether it is within a state facility or at their homes. But that decision can only come when we have all the information that we require to make that decision.
Thank you. Tobago, Channel 5.
Hi, good morning. Candace Jackson from Tobago Channel 5. My question is for the CMO. What have you seen about what has been most successful in terms of treatments towards our COVID patients here in Trinidad and Tobago?
So, as you have noted before, we still don't have, as the world, we don't have a specific treatment for COVID-19, so there's no specific treatment. The ICU practitioners have done their usual job in terms of intensive care support, high dependency unit support, meaning that we are supporting the patients as they need. They would have had a few patients on ventilatory support, and Dr. Parkinson would have gone into length as to how a ventilator works. So we are doing what is called supportive care. There's no specific treatment, and we are following our clinical guidelines from WHO as was laid out from the start. And we continue to do so.
Minister Cox, before we go to the next question, may I just remind the media that there were many questions over the past couple of weeks about the pediatric population. We do have with us Dr. Joanne Paul. It is difficult to bring her back. So please, if we could use this opportunity, because the media had a lot of questions about the pediatric population and COVID. So let's take advantage of her presence here this morning. Thank you.
Okay. Were you finished, Doctor?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. We move to Newsday.
Hello, morning.
Good morning. Morning. Identify yourself, please.
Yes, morning, Flint Chantak Newsday. Yes, Flint Chantak Newsday.
Hmm? Yes.
Your questions? We are hearing you.
Yes. Right. I wanted to ask the minister, regarding what you said about surveillance testing and so on, ramping it up. Are you all looking to how soon is that information going to be, say, readily available to the recovery team that the Prime Minister is heading in terms of guiding them in terms of when we re-engage and when we don't?
Okay, so,
and secondly, I wanted to also ask whether the with regards to the stocks of PPE you all have in the country, what's the current level at?
Sure.
And are we experiencing any challenges in terms of getting that PPE in? And is it a situation that some other countries might be hoarding the supplies and we're not getting it?
Okay. So let me take the first part of the question. I could tell you that Minister Robert LeHunt has reached out to me, and he is to give me, a shopping list of what Trinidad post-COVID or during COVID would look like. We will be compiling that scenario for Minister LeHunt and pass it on to him, which I am sure he will feed into the Prime Minister's team for the post-COVID recovery. So the answer is yes. The CMO will come up with the different matrices and so on. On the question of PPE, yes, as I have said time and time again, there are international challenges with PPE. However, we in Trinidad and Tobago currently, with our current caseload, are in no danger of running out of PPP. However, if persons do not heed the call to stay home and we get a second and third waves, which are bigger than the first wave, we will be in trouble like any other country. I shared with the media and the national community that we actually did a count. It takes us 1,187 pieces of PPE to treat one COVID-positive patient. Think about that. And we keep showing the pyramid. I don't know if they could put it back up again. The pyramid of infection. You have one person at the top of that pyramid taking roughly 1,200 pieces of PPE. At the bottom of that pyramid, he infects 10 people. That moves it to 12,000 pieces of PPE. And then those 10 people infect 100 people. That's 120-something thousand pieces of PPE. And we will run out, like any other country in the world, and have to use garbage bags as gowns if the population does not heed the call to stay home. So far, so good. But don't test the system and throw us back to the Stone Ages. So that is where we are right now. We are in a decent place. But, if we don't heed the call to stay home, we will be thrown back into the Stone Ages like many other countries in the world that are richer than us, have more bed to patient ratio. Please, stay home.
Thank you. Before we move on, I have a question for the CMO. Mm-hmm. Will the Cuban doctors be tested for the COVID-19 virus before they are deployed into our system?
Okay.
So the Cuban nurses that come in, they would be put in self-quarantine for a period of 14 days. If they become symptomatic at any stage, they will be tested just like anyone else. We have also received documentation from Cuba which indicates their medical status prior to them coming to us. But they will be quarantined at a state facility for the 14 days before they are deployed into the healthcare workforce.
Thank you. Astronaut News.
Gwyneth Stewart, Astronaut Health Newspaper. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Gwyneth.
My question is concerning the nurses who are in the step-down facilities. Is there any plan for a time limit of their stay in terms of maybe isolating them after a period of time, and so that they would not be constantly exposed to the incoming influx of new patients.
Right. So in terms of the way we deal with the healthcare workers at those stations, I would have visited Home of Football and Takrigo yesterday myself. They are what we call hot zones and cold zones, right? These are patients that require very minimal levels of care. So they are patients that would have been in hospital, have now recovered. They actually have no symptoms. They are waiting their first negative. Some of them are waiting their second negative. So there's a hot zone where the patients are, meaning, and it's well cordoned off. It's between the hot and the cold zone. So the nurses only enter the hot zone if and when needed for a very small period of time. And they wear, of course, the PPE that is required. There's a station for putting on, donning your PPE before you go in. There's a station for doffing it, taking it off. And, of course, doing all these sanitary measures, hand washing, etc. They, as I said, the key to it is really having them in there for minimal amounts of time at any period of time. They, most of the time, they spend in the cold zone, which is outside of the area where the patients are. If there's any issues, then they don their PPE and they go into the hot zone. So that's the way we control in terms of infection and cross-contamination within that setting. Really minimal contact and using your PPE when you're there. And they stay on site for the entire duration of the time where they're looking after that group of people. There's no back and forth usually to their home or anything else. And there would be a period of decontamination at the end as well.
Wire 868.
Hi, good day. Lasana Libel, Wired 868.
Morning, Lasana.
Yes, morning. To help us gauge what is happening in the communities, could you give an idea of maybe the number of phone calls reported in COVID symptoms that we got after the first case in March, and perhaps over the last 2 weeks, and what you read from that? And also, out of the 50-odd positive cases outside of the cruise ship passengers, how many have we completed contact tracing for? And if you could give an idea of what that process entails.
Sure. Okay, so Lasana, I'll tell you the first part of the question, and you read my mind. We normally have a meeting at 8:45 every morning before we come here. We have a 14-member team at the ministry dealing with this. And I asked for that same statistic this morning. So hopefully I'll have it for you tomorrow as to the number of calls. Okay? Okay. Yeah.
In terms of contact tracing, I believe Dr. Hines would have indicated that for the cohort generally, the primary and secondary contacts would have been upwards of 715 yesterday when he was on air. We are continuously tracking all of them, and we go beyond secondary exposure. We go to tertiary exposure as well, just to be on the safe side. And as we have seen, if someone, for instance, would have attended in the early days, you want to ask something else before I continue?
You said how many people we have looked at so far. I just wanted to know how many of the actual patients that we did contact tracing for as well.
Outside of the cruise ship, because the cruise ship would not have had contact to anyone in Trinidad. As you know, they would have been taken straight off the aircraft and went into Balandra. So those passengers are separate and apart in terms of contact tracing. So they would not have had any contact tracing done on that group. But outside of that, Dr. Hines would have indicated upwards of 715, and that includes the 62 odd at the time that we would have had. And of course, once we get persons added to that list, we will do contact tracing, primary, secondary, and tertiary contacts of all of them, making sure that they understand that they need to stay home, and in cases where you have families, the families need to stay home, which is the most important thing, in the event that they do get symptoms within that 14-day period. So that's the critical part of what we are doing now, the most critical part in terms of contact tracing. It is extremely important. So every case that we get, we try to link them to primary, secondary, and tertiary contacts, making sure those people know that they're not supposed to move about, because if one of those people move about with mild symptoms, even go to crowded areas, go to areas where we have a high volume of people, the risk is very great. As we saw the pyramid, there can be a cascade of infection occurring. So once you are listed as a primary, secondary, or tertiary contact, you're actually supposed to be home during the entire stay. So that's how we are doing the contact tracing, and it continues. Just to give an example, if you have a contact in a school, for instance, in the early days, we would have had those, or a university, we're looking at thousands of people that were primary and secondary and tertiary contacts that were listed in those cases. So just to give an idea of what was happening and what is happening at the Ministry of Health to trace those people.
Thank you. I have a question. I think maybe it's for the Minister. What happened to the 4,000 test kits from China?
Sure. So as we indicated yesterday, 1,750 of those kits will now be in use because we got in the extraction kits. And it is those kits now, extraction kits, matched to the test kits from China, we are going to start to use to ramp up our testing from next week, Monday, I think we are hoping for. Thank you.
Thank you. Yolan Thomas?
Yes, good morning to the minister and the CMO, as well as media practitioners. I just wanted to find out from the CMO, persons who would have died of COVID-19, is there any evidence to suggest that cremation is better as opposed to burial?
No, so there isn't any evidence to support either one, to be honest, and we are allowing both cremations or burials to occur, but the cremations, when they occur, are occurring within a crematorium setting and not on an open pyre. So that's the difference in terms of containment. The WHO has recommended both, either or, and we have used in Trinidad either cremation or burial as well.
91.9.
Hi, good morning. We're next to Voice Street 91.9 FM. Dr. Paul.
Good morning. Mm-hmm.
Hi, Dr. Paul, I just want to pose one question to you and probably one other going across to the minister and the CMO. Dr. Paul, are we saying that then children are essentially going to just be carriers of the virus and they, if they get infected, they would simply just be able to pass it on to a granny, a mommy, and they are essentially carriers? Would that be accurate to say? And I also wanted to just also ask, one second, I lost my position and my text here. Right. Are we exploring other tests aside from the current long swab test that we are using right now? Just this morning, Sandra Gupta on CNN said that they had gotten approval for another test in the U.S. Are we looking at other testing options as well? Those are my two. Thank you. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for that question. I would not say that they are carriers. I would say that most of them are milder. So the thing is that if you have 10 children and 10 adults, the 10 children will have mild symptoms. Of the 10 adults, they'll have maybe 5 will be mild, and maybe a few more might be a bit more symptomatic. So therefore, in terms of numbers comparison, it may seem that they're all carriers, but it means that we have to watch them. They generally will be milder, but they can, the same way as adults who are in Price Mart or wherever, the same way anybody who's mild can have that virus transmitted as a carrier. So with the kids, though, the same way as you, the adult, or the adolescent, or the person who is less than 65, you are still posing a risk to your older personnel. So we all have to make sure we maintain with regards to hand hygiene and also some sort of isolation. All I'm saying is that once they have mild symptoms, be extra careful and protect your older patient, the older relative, from yourself or your child. Thank you.
Okay, so, and just to add to Dr. Paul, what she has said, children, generally speaking, as I said before, cannot social distance the way an adult will. So there may be an inherent greater risk with a child. So they may not be able to do the hand hygiene and everything else like an adult social distancing. So there may be a greater risk for asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic child spreading it to other members of the family, as opposed to a mildly symptomatic adult. In terms of your testing question, I don't know if you're speaking of antibody versus antigen testing, just to clear it up?
No. The testing that Dr. Gupta was talking about this morning was the actual swab.
Okay.
They are shorter swabs that are a little less intrusive, that don't go as far into the membrane as others.
Okay, so yeah, so there are various types of swabs that we use in Trinidad from time to time and Tobago. So there may be different lengths, but in terms of the technique is the most important part and the way we train the physicians as to how to actually do the nasopharyngeal swab and be as least invasive as possible. So it's, I think it's more the technique than the actual length of the swab, because you can use, you don't have to use the entire length of a swab when you're doing a nasopharyngeal swab. So the training of the physicians or the healthcare practitioner is extremely important, and that we have done time and time again to ensure that the process and the procedure is done accurately without any injury or any as minimally invasive as possible to the population.
Loop Titi.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning to Dr. Paul. This is Nika Pasanal from Dr. Paul, you had mentioned that children generally have a greater chance of survival. But what about those with pre-existing conditions like asthma, maybe something else respiratory related? Is there any way parents can differentiate symptoms that they may be used to seeing versus COVID-related symptoms? Is there any advice you can offer them? And for the CMO, is there any specific updates you can give us on the last three in Volandra who had those last-minute positives? Have we been paying any specific attention to them?
Thanks for your question. That's a really good question. So if, for instance, as a parent, remember my primary responsibility is to make sure I protect my child, I'm aware of what's happening. If my child has, as we mentioned, cerebral palsy, uncontrolled or severe asthmatic, diabetes, cancer, heart conditions, sickle cell disease, I know my child is at greater risk. So first of all, I will make sure and isolate a bit more. I wouldn't be going on play dates. I would not be going with my child to the pharmacy, etc. I'll be making sure I stay at home as much as possible. If, for instance, my child becomes febrile, having a fever, cough, and seems to have milder symptoms, that will probably talk to my pediatrician or my family doctor a little bit earlier. But also, as I mentioned before, if they start having those signs of worsened distress, where you're seeing them breathing faster, do not wait for too long. You know, especially that this child, although it's milder with all children, your child who has those extra illnesses is at higher risk. So I would say take them straight away, seek medical attention, don't take a chance. Go to your hospital, health center, peripheral emergency department. Make sure you tell them my child has this and I'm worried about COVID and I want to be seen and assessed appropriately. So be very cautious with those. I don't want us to just be carte blanche and be happy, oh yeah, and my child is going to be mild. There are some populations, less than 2 years old especially, there are some populations who are still very vulnerable, and we have to take this very seriously. Thank you.
Just answer Lisanna. Lisanna, I just got some information for you. From the 14th to the 20th of April, there were 954 calls. This shows a sharp reduction from when we set up the hotline in the very beginning, where there were thousands of calls. So just from the period 14th to 20th, 954 calls.
Yep, so in terms of the three persons at Volandra, yes, we are paying particular attention to them. They are doing well. There's no major concern in terms of their clinical status. We have also sent a report to the Pan-American Health Organization's country office, which they subsequently sent to the Washington, D.C. office to have a look at it. Their conclusions are more or less in alignment with what we are saying initially, where they would have been closer contact with a particular positive group of person or individuals in that group. But we are paying particular attention to it because it seems like an outlier because of their mild symptoms or asymptomatic presentation and having a positive result. So in terms of looking at them for not research, but having a very close look at them to see how the presentations are, because it is a novel virus. So we are looking at them closely.
Okay, I go back to 98.1. One
yes,
question,
thank
please.
Thank you so much again for allowing me. Dr. Paul, how robust is the pediatric system in the country at this time? That's the first question. And the other one, protocols when schools do open. Do you have any advice for teachers, etc.?
Thanks for that first question. I'll leave the other part for the minister or the CMO. With regards to the how robust the pediatric system, the pediatricians themselves have a really strong setup right now, and we're communicating very aggressively with each other to know what's happening. So we have our private pediatricians who are still open. We have the community doctors who are engaged, the peripheral emergency medicine systems, and all the pediatricians in hospital and ourselves. So any protocols we actually make, we disseminate. So we have meetings once a week. We disseminate via WhatsApp and we discuss what's happening. So they know exactly what patients are where, what's happening. We are all updating ourselves in the newest protocol to make sure we know what's to do best for all our pediatric population. We have had a few patients come through. As you know, we have had only one confirmed case so far which the minister had mentioned and the CM had mentioned before, who is at Cora. Aside from that, we have had a few who have been tested and they have been negative. And all the ones who we were querying, we discussed with the team, with Dr. Trotman, with the ID team, with the medical chiefs of staff, assess the patient, discuss with all the pediatricians and see what's happening, because we're very focused on making sure we take care of any child who has symptoms, especially moderate to severe symptoms. We're very focused on making sure that nothing happens to that child as much as we can.
Okay, thank you. I'll take the other part of the question, because the protocols for school opening, that's a policy decision. As we said, the Honourable Prime Minister, by the end of this week, as he indicated in his press conference last week, will liaise with the public health officials led by the Chief Medical Officer to get their opinion as to the status of the country to help him make the correct decisions on opening any part of the system, whether it's business, whether it's schools. However, I want to reiterate, any talk at this time about opening anything is premature and will feed into a narrative in the public domain that is contrary to what we are trying to do. That is to keep people at home. The message coming out today should be one of caution, should be one of prevention of community spread, and the only way we can do that is to stay home. Hope that answers your question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. I go back to Newsday.
Right. Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes,
ma'am. Yes, we're hearing you.
Hello, are you hearing me?
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Yes, we are hearing you.
Hello?
You're not hearing us. Yes, Clint, we are hearing you.
Hello?
Okay, let's go to somebody else until that is cleared up, the audio. I move to Wire 868, and then we'll go back to Newsday.
Yes, thanks for the information, Minister. Is there an average on how many from every 10 or 50 calls or whatever would require testing?
Okay, so listen, I wouldn't have that detail on me.
Okay.
But if you request it, we will try and get it for you.
No problem. And also, how long would it usually take for the persons who call in with symptoms to be tested once they call in?
Okay, maybe the CMO can answer. I wouldn't have that detail.
Yeah, once somebody calls in and is flagged as a person that might be suspect, that goes straight away to the principal medical officer of epidemiology in real time, and he would make contact with the county medical officers of health. They normally liaise directly with the person. So within a few hours to a day, they would be contacted, and arrangements be made if they have to be swabbed for that to be done.
Okay, could we see if we can get back down to Newsday? I think there was an audio problem.
Yes.
Hello?
Are you hearing us?
Yes, I'm hearing you.
Okay, good.
Okay, I wanted to ask, this is actually a question for both Ministers Bialsing and Cox. You've had one of your parliamentary colleagues, Prakash Ramadan, expressing some concerns that you've had a bit of overreach by government within recent times regarding some of the public health regulations and all of that. And he was questioning whether there's going to be any parliamentary sitting anytime soon to deal with any of these matters. So anything either of you could say on this?
Okay, so I can confirm that and it's public knowledge, if you go onto the Parliament website, there is a sitting of the Parliament, I believe, for...
Yes, there's a sitting scheduled for Monday, and actually the order papers went out yesterday. So there is a sitting of Parliament scheduled for Monday. CNC3?
Minister.
Morning.
Hi, good morning. Are you hearing us? CNC3? Okay, I think it's frozen. Mm-hmm. This may be the time for us to end, because we are out of time. We've come to the end of today's virtual media conference. Do remember that the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Communications are your only credible sources of government information on COVID-19. We know you might feel bored and all these restrictions might feel uncomfortable, but leaving your home is not the answer. Staying home saves lives. Breaking isolation increases your chances of contracting COVID-19. So we are appealing to you once again to follow the public health guidelines. Please remember that staying home will save life, your life, and those of others. I am Donna Cox, Minister of Communications. Thank you for joining us today as the government continues its efforts to flatten the curve and beat COVID-19. Stay home, stay safe. May God bless Trinidad and Tobago.